Yle Podcast.
Hello and welcome to All Points North, the podcast with the lowdown on Finnish news this week. In this show, we're looking at myths about feminism, the Me Too movement, a controversial railway project in Lapland, and we ask whether sauna can help protect against stroke.
This is the All Points North podcast, telling you everything you need to know about Finland this week.
Hello everyone, it's time for our weekly podcast, All Points North. I'm Egan Richardson and my co-presenter this week is Denise Wall. Good to see you, Denise.
Thanks for having me, Egan.
Our special guest in the studio this week is activist and writer Marian Abdul-Karim. It's great to have you back, Marian.
Thank you. Good afternoon to everyone.
Good afternoon. Now, Marian, you've co-authored a new book and in English it's called Around 10 Myths About Feminism. The book is in Finnish and it's not really Google translatable. So can you explain briefly what the book is about?
Well, I think the title says it all. It's about myths that are associated with feminism, and because we're living at a time where even in Finland, feminism has somewhat mainstreamed. But there are still a lot of misconceptions that are related to feminism. Like, what do feminists really want? Like, you know, do they want to bring men down, or like, you know, are feminists dateable? All feminists do not want men opening doors for them, etc. So these are the kind of myths that are often voiced on social media, etc. So me and Evelina Talvitie, we kind of looked into those myths and we kind of tried to dismantle them piece by piece. So that's what the book's about.
Now, we'll probably get into some of them a bit later on in more detail, but one of the terms that I came across in a summary of the book, I did not have time to read it last night, is the term intersectional feminism, which basically acknowledges that not all feminists are white, middle-class, cisgendered, or able-bodied. In terms of feminism in Finland, how far do you think the movement has come to recognizing that, and how far do you still think it has to go?
Well, there is still a distance to be covered in terms of, you know, when we look at the society, when we look at the structures that still exist, we can all pretty much agree that we're not still on equal playing field. So for that to happen, we need to use the tools that are available through the intersectional feminism. And what it really means is not that, you know, all feminists, it's about human beings. Mm. As individuals, like Audre Lorde, one of my favorite thinkers, poets, has said, we do not live single-issued lives, so there can be no single-issued struggles. And for her, it was about being someone who was born to immigrant family in the United States at a time when racial discrimination in the U.S. was like really a big issue. So to be raised in that environment as a young black woman who at her teens discovers that she's also queer was something that kind of put her to analyze and think about the society around her and what obstacles exist. So for like the reason why we are now discussing intersectional feminism, or why more and more feminists are waking up to that, is because for a long time in the West, feminism has been equated as something that has to do with middle class white women who are cis and who are, you know, straight, opposing the structures that allow men to have more power than them. And now we're saying that not everyone is a white straight female, not everyone is male. And beyond that, it's that not every man has equal amount of opportunities in this society. So if you take, for example, middle-class, straight, educated woman and a guy who's, you know, perhaps not so educated or perhaps struggling with some disability, then you already have this balance in the power. And you can no longer say that, you know, he as a male has more power than the female, because there are certain obstacles that are hindering him that are not hindering her. So in that sense, it's really crucial and very, very important that we kind of look at the whole picture and have a holistic view of our society and where the, you know, segregation or marginalizing is happening, and identify that. And we cannot do that, like, you know, by saying that, okay, now we're just going to focus. For example, if you happen to be a female and, you know, your struggle is now to get equal pay. But what if you are someone who's living with a disability? Then already securing a job is your first obstacle.
Yes.
And then you can worry about the equal pay. So to kind
so
of understand this.
It's not about feminism as a binary construct, or which pitches women, a certain kind of woman, against the male patriarchy.
Yeah, there are also differences happening within women. You know, not all women are on the same level. So to kind of understand that and work from that point of view.
Excellent.
I just wanted to ask, probably feeding into that, about one particular myth, number six. Mm. I think that you can't be a feminist if you wear a headscarf. Mm. And I guess that comes from your personal experience a little bit. So I just wanted to ask, like, could you expand a little bit? How did you debunk that myth?
Well, we were discussing with Evelina and talking about, because she has a long hair and I wear the scarf, and there's these stereotypes, like the stereotypical feminist is someone who's, you know, with a short hair and, like, you know, quite butch.
That's like me.
And that we're not.
That's what I look like.
Yeah, that neither of us really fits into the stereotype. So we wanted to kind of take that apart and say, like, okay, so I'm wearing the scarf, I'm still a feminist. You have the long hair and you're still a feminist. So what does this myth really mean? What is it feeding into the discourse? And yeah. It's more is in the book. Okay. I don't want to give everything away here.
Is your book ever going to be translated into English, though?
Hopefully. It would be really amazing. Although we do understand that in the English-speaking world, there is a lot of books on feminism. And this is one of the reasons why we wanted to write something very basic about feminism, because there are not many available in Finnish language. It's only now that, you know, we see more and more people writing about issues that are regarded as feminist or from feminist perspective, like, you know, Koko Hubara is one of them, right. Saara Särmä, Rosa Meriläinen. So we have some available now, but, you know, we need more that are not coming straight from the academia, but more like from the grassroots level, or these actual realities that we live in and that are by non-academics. Not to say that, you know, academia doesn't matter. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we use come from the academic research that happens. But most times, for a lot of us, the academic texts are not as easy to approach.
Sure, of course.
What's the reception been like to the book? What kind of reactions do you get?
It's been quite good. There have been some people who have found it that, you know, maybe they haven't read the book because they go back to the same stereotypes. I get some amount of messaging about, you know, why do I want to keep the men down, or why am I not interested in the things that are happening in Finland more if they're not related to the white men, and it's like, please read the book first.
Yes.
And then let's continue the conversation, because there are a lot of topics that we are covering within the text. So
one of the myths that I wanted to ask you about, particularly to do with the Finnish context, is myth number 11 of your about 10 myths, which says that feminism is pointless because Finland has already achieved gender equality. Tell us what you're getting at there.
The thing is, a lot of times when you are speaking from a feminist point of view, or you're saying that, you know, we have to do this and this and this, there will be people who will say that, oh, in Finland we have had this one female president, Tarja Halonen, and we've even had a female prime minister, Anneli Jäätteenmäki. So, you know, we're there already. Equality is a reality. And that makes a really hard start for a conversation about all of the people who are still living in a very unequal situation. So if the person you're trying to conversate with over the topic is already in the understanding that, you know, everything is ready now, so we no longer need to address this issue, then it makes it really hard. So that's why we wanted to include that, because we think it's really important to understand that even though we have made a lot of progress, but we're not there yet.
Yeah. It seems to me that in my mind, generally, there is a kind of disconnect between the fact that there's still ground to be covered in terms of achieving gender parity in some areas, for example, pay. Mm. I mean, women are still earning, is it 70-odd cents to the man's 1 euro in terms of pay, in general terms, in terms of representation on corporate boards and so on, that there seems to be a disconnect between the ground that needs to be covered there and what feminism is trying to do. It seems like people seem to perceive them as two completely separate forces. How would you help people to try and connect those dots?
Well, I think it's already start to listen to the people who are speaking about these issues, about, like, you know, the women who are in these different fields where the representation is not a reality yet. And instead of dismissing their valid critique as, you know, bitter feminists who are not qualified enough to actually look at it, like, what are the qualifications that we're looking at? And is it really true that in a country where we have an extremely good education, that our women are not just making the cut when it comes to these specific positions? Or can it be that it's the structures that somehow pave the way more easily for those regarded as men in this society than the women? And also about the pay gap, I think it's 82 cents to the euro at the moment, but that is that is accurate when you look at the middle class educated women to the middle class educated men. But then when you look at, for example, different minorities, or if you look at the disabled women or women who are living with disabilities, then the number changes drastically. Because, like, you know, we still live in a situation where people who are living with emotional disabilities, they're not even getting paid a salary for the work that they do. They get some kind of compensation, but it's not really a salary that they can live off on.
Right. And there, sorry, in that last mention, we see the intersectionality again of the issue.
I was going to ask about that, actually. Is there, because when I read about feminism in the UK or in the US, there is a kind of a debate within feminism about this intersectionality and different aspects of feminism. And it's almost a dispute. There are people on different sides of the argument. Is that divide present in Finland as well?
I think some of it is definitely present in Finland as well. There are people who have been, you know, in the feminist struggle for decades, and there are people who are newer to the scene. And sometimes you can see that some people are not very happy with the intersectionalism because for them it feels like it's highlighting different minorities and somehow leaving behind the middle-class white woman, as if her issues are not relevant to the cause. And that is, well, I want to say that that's not true, but then again, I think if that is the experience that they have, then of course those concerns are valid, because we don't want to say that, you know, for you to be a feminist, an intersectional feminist, you have to have all of these different qualities. I think every concern is relevant, and we need to be able to look at it in the context of feminism and the society and what is the reality now. One of my favorite lecturers or like thinkers, Amina Wadud, was visiting Finland, and one of the points that she made regarding, for example, privileges was that we have two different levels. Like, we have this state of being and we have this state of non-being. And those who are in this state of being, they might have struggles that are relevant, but for them to kind of like demand those that who are still in the state of not being to take on their struggles, it might be too soon, or like, you know, because when you're in the state of non-being, it means that you are still in the struggle for your basic humanity, or trying to get somewhere. You're trying to get to the state of being. And after that, you can again share these similar struggles with those who are already in the state of being. So how to then move from that? But I think this will take a lot of conversations and, you know, a lot of debates for us to move closer in our understanding that these issues are not very simple.
A long way to go.
It certainly sounds very complex, and there's a lot to talk about. Now, we do have a lot more coming up in today's podcast, but we'd like to bring in our listener's voice at this point. And we've got a question from Gareth in Kittila. And what he's asking is, what can a white, foreign-born male over the age of 40 do to help promote the equal treatment of women in this age of Me Too? Well, so, Marianne, what advice do you have for Gareth?
Gareth, support your local feminists. Look at what the issues are, and when you can, you know, be of help in a sense of kind of like amplifying the voices, saying like, you know, retweeting something that is relevant, do that. But then also we all need to be able to look at ourselves, like, what am I doing in this situation, and what are my privileges, and how can I use them? And there are spaces, like, once again, I go back to Audre Lorde, who said that when I talk to different audiences, the point is that I can reach a certain audience. And I know that they will listen and they will think about what I'm saying. But then there are those who I can never reach because of certain gaps or structures or whatever. So if you are in a position where you can reach those who wouldn't listen to me, then talk to them and, you know, pave the way for them so we can all be in the know.
Now, you mentioned Twitter, just very quickly. You mentioned Twitter, and I was thinking when you said that, when you talked about supporting feminist voices and themes and ideas, it sounds to me like social media is a place where the ordinary person can get involved and help promote that kind of that kind of thinking. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. I think social media has, we've talked about a lot about the trolls and about, like, you know, harassment on social media, which is true. But the other side of the coin is that a lot of good things are happening in social media. A lot of voices are getting stronger because of social media. People who would never have, like, you know, platforms on the traditional medias have a platform on the social media where they can voice their opinions and so on. And we are in a point where we have social media superstars, for example, who are, you know, opinion leaders or
influencers.
Activists. Yeah, influencers. So I think social media is something to be definitely taken seriously. And, you know, wherever we can somehow minimize the harm and so on, then we should definitely do that.
Right.
I just wanted to ask, relating to Gareth's question, is it ever possible for men to be feminists, or should they describe themselves some other way, or what's the terminology around this?
That is a really interesting question. And I think we have a chapter in the book called A Man Cannot Be a Feminist and a Woman Cannot Be a Sexist. And it sounds ridiculous, which it is. And we are discussing that also. I think feminism is an ideology. I mean, it's not tied to a gender. So if you are for the ideas that are within the feminism, and if you're willing to use it as a tool in your, you know, everyday lived realities, in your work and so on, then anyone can be a feminist regardless of their gender.
Now, Gareth talks about the age of Me Too, and it seems that the global Me Too movement has been a kind of lightning rod, sort of reviving feminists who may have been maybe in a bit of a Cinderella sleep for a while. Sorry, Sleeping Beauty sleep for a while. How do you think that movement has played out in Finland?
I think Me Too has made us a bit more sensitive to things that have been here for a while, that a lot of people are struggling with. The stories coming out has allowed us to have a clearer image of what actually happens, so to say, behind the scenes. I think we haven't heard all the stories yet, and I think there's a lot of ground to cover when it comes to people being able to live their everyday lives, to go to their works, to their place of study, and actually not be harassed by anyone else. And as a result of the Me Too, you know, you have a lot of conversation about what is appropriate now, can I do this, can I do that? And I think these questions are really important. And more important is, like, you know, the realization that if I have to ask, is my way of flirting okay? Then probably it's not. So don't do it. Yeah. Like, if the question comes up in your mind that, you know, can I do this with another individual? And you're already thinking yourself, like, is it okay? It probably is not okay.
Red flag.
Yes. Okay. So listen to your, you know,
your
listen to yourself.
Voice.
Yes. And don't do it.
Sorry.
And I think another thing is that because we're also sensitive around this question, whenever someone mentions a female's looks, then this becomes already like, you know, whoa, like, can you talk about a woman in that way? And I think over this week, like, one of the most bizarre situations I've been following on Twitter is the White House has this press, what do you call it?
The White House
correspondence.
Yeah, dinner, where they usually have every year a stand-up comedian do a little bit of a stand-up. And it's been, you know, quite mellow over the years. But now you had Michelle Wolf do the stand-up. And one of the things that she said was that she was criticizing Sarah Sanders Huckabee, who's working for the administration of Donald Trump. And she said that, you know, she burns facts and she uses the ashes of these burnt facts to create a perfect eyeshadow.
Smoky eye.
Yes.
Was the term. Yeah.
So this was the joke. But somehow it got twisted into this comedian attacking another woman's physical looks, which, I mean, I had to watch it again just to make sure that I understand the jokes right, because English is not my first language. And with the second listening, still, she was saying that, you know, she uses burnt facts, ashes, to use for a perfect smoky eye. And I was like, that was a really good joke, in a sense, because she's, you know, attacking the Trump administration, and she's kind of talking about this false news that they keep bringing people around and so on. But yeah, but that was really interesting that under the Me Too time, this became an issue of, you know, a lot of people were saying on Twitter that, you know, she's very sexist because she was talking about these women. I was like, no, she actually wasn't.
So a kind of hypersensitivity arising out of the Me Too movement.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
All Points North. News from Finland.
If you have something on your mind, just send your audio message to our All Points North WhatsApp account. Our WhatsApp number is +358 44 421 0909.
Now onto a somewhat different topic. Up in Finnish Lapland, plans are afoot for the construction of a railway that would run from the northern city of Rovaniemi to Norway's deep sea port of Kirkenes, about 15 kilometres from the Russian border. The idea, of course, is to develop trade routes and business opportunities in the area.
Of course, economic development is all well and good, but there is a catch. The proposed rail connection would cut through the sleepy town of Inari and would also hammer its way through reindeer herding territory, something that some of the affected Sami reindeer herders and owners aren't too happy about.
Our reporter Lydia Taylorson went up to Inari to gauge the temperature on both sides of the debate. Let's hear what she found out.
Walking along the main road of the small Lapland town of Inari, nestled amongst the rolling fells and Lake Inarijärvi, frozen solid under the open sky, I can't help but admire the cozy small town feel. What can generously be called the town's bus rolls to a stop outside the only food shop as two old ladies perch on the front seats, swapping stories. The town is located on the lands of the Sapmi, home to the indigenous Sami, where the road signs are also in the native language, and where the tradition of reindeer herding is practiced in the local forests. It's a rustic scene, and a productive one too, with some 6,700 reindeer owners spread across one-third of the country's landmass. But the quiet hum of this Lapland town may soon be replaced by the baritone rumble of freight cars and the howl of diesel train engines.
It could bring us more tourists, it would bring more opportunities for travelling, and also for the local people travelling to south and improving the connections here. And when we are thinking about the future and climate change, and for example, we don't know what's going to happen with the air traffic in the future, if there will be, for example, some extra fees because of the emissions and so on. So it would be a great opportunity to have a railway connection.
That was the mayor of Inari, Toni K. Laine, discussing the possible benefits of the Arctic Ocean Railway. The proposed railway is slated to run through the sleepy town to link southern Finland with the busy deep-sea port at Kirkenes in Norway. Some hail the railway as a beacon of hope for increased trade and a venture that would boost industries in the north. One downside, however, is that the railway would grind through several reindeer herding regions. While Mayor Laine hasn't yet made up his mind about the railway, many local Sami are staunchly opposed. This includes Tiina Sanila-Aikio, president of the Sami Parliament in Finland, who warns of the dangers of the railway that would cut through the territories of three Sami language groups.
We think that it's not only the railroad, but it will take more and have more effects than just as a model of transport. It will bring with it, for example, mines, or it will increase the logging.
Well, I think the whole idea about the Arctic Railway is insane. If you think our environmental values and cultural values we have here, reindeer herding is a way of life. You can kind of lose meaning from your life, and it's really difficult to find other meanings. And it's already has like mental pressure for reindeer herders, because you have this gray cloud upon your shoulders that the future is not in our hands. And also when I think about my children, who are really keen of continuing reindeer herding, because reindeer has so big meaning for Sami. It's basis of our material culture. It's basis of our spiritual culture. It's something that keeps languages alive.
The harsh reality of what may come does not seem far from the minds of locals. At the centre lies a clash between the needs of industry and the Sami, but the locals seem set on continuing their age-old traditions.
I have been starting to build my life around the reindeers. I have lived with the reindeer for almost all my life, and I want to be a reindeer herder for all my life.
And that was Lydia Taylorson reporting from Lapland. Now, Marion, do you think Sami voices are heard enough on this and on other topics as well?
Well, I think we have to go a bit back to history and look at the relationship between the Sami areas and the Sami people and the state of Finland for the time that it has existed. Over the few last decades, the Sami indigenous people have been subjected to different kind of changes by the state that have been mandated. It has included moving them from place to place. It has included forcing the Finnish language, the assimilation politics on them, etc. And at the same time, what we have happening in the mainstream media is these caricatures of the indigenous peoples, like the Sami. If you look at what was happening in the 70s and the 80s, all these Nunnukalala type of, like, you know, like misrepresentations of the Sami. And that combined with the reality where we don't have that much representation of the Sami or their histories in our school books creates a huge void for an average Finn living in this country. Like, what is the relation between the Finns and the indigenous people? And I think that this might be one of the reasons why it's really hard for a lot of the indigenous people to get their voices through and to have this media platform to actually have serious debates of what is happening up north, what is at stake, how are they being treated, what has been the impact of the previous steps that have been taken towards them, etc. But I think sometimes it's a lot easier to just discuss when the indigenous peoples are upset. You know, you can read all these articles like Samis are once again upset because we are doing this. Like, and now latest was with Yle, this Mr. Heinämäki case, where the character was criticized by a Sami activist, Petra Laiti, who is the chair for the Sami youth. And she just pointed out that, you know, is this of a modern time, like, is this still relevant? And they had a discussion in Yle, which was a really good discussion, apparently, because then they decided that, yeah, it's not really a good representation of these times. So they decided to move it to the Elävä arkisto as part of these historic things that have happened. And now you have a lot of, like, you know, uproar, like people were for days discussing this issue. But when it comes to more pressing situations like what is happening with the Arctic Railroad, then it feels like it's not as media sexy because, you know, now we're talking about real stuff and we're talking about real people's lives and what will happen in the future, etc. So, I don't know. I think there should be more platform from the indigenous people to have actual discussions on these issues that affect their lives and that affect their futures. But they also affect the future of this country when we're talking about climate change and what will be the consequences of this Arctic Railroad. So I really hope that it will not be kind of pushed forward because there is a pressure from the industry, but rather we will move forward by listening to the indigenous peoples. And
you make a good point about how over the years the Sami have been sort of exoticized by mainstream Finland and how that has undermined addressing these very concrete issues. In terms of this very specific issue that we're looking at, where on the one side we're having the voice of the Sami sort of agitating for being able to continue with their traditional way of life, and the opposing side of the fence, which is a question of economic development by way of a railroad. How do you think that the Sami can realistically argue their case in that kind of a question?
Well, I think there have been a lot of really good arguments on this, once again, on Twitter, on different social media platforms, where different Sami activists, experts have written their views on this. And, you know, I really hope that mainstream media will be able to look into those and put those claims forward or those arguments so that we can, you know, have a more rational discussion about it and not just say, like, you know, oh, money comes first. Mm. Because when we think of money comes first, it might be good for a short time. But are we really looking at the long-term impact of what might happen? Because, like, Tiina Sanila Aikio, the chair for the Sami parliament, the president of Sami parliament, was just saying now on the clip that it's not just the railroad that they're worried about, it's what comes after, what comes with it. And it will bring different things to the area, which will not be necessarily good only. So to just, like, really look at the whole thing holistically and maybe not look at it like, you know, the industry versus the Sami, but like, what is the good of the area? And
okay. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
I'm sure you could go on.
Probably. But but you can have next week maybe someone from the Sami community to come in and talk about it more broadly.
And now it's time for a roundup of the week's main stories. The week started controversially when a statement from the officers' union singled out dual Finnish-Russian citizens as a security threat. The statement, made on April the 27th, says the union does not condone dual citizens of Russia and Finland being selected for high-ranking positions in the Finnish military in cases in which the dual citizenship could present a danger to national security.
And three senior police officers face charges of official misconduct for allegedly looking the other way while corrupt cop Jari Arnio improperly registered and paid informants. The prosecutor says that former National Police Commissioner Mikko Paatero, current chief Lasse Apio, and former police commander Jukka Riikonen knew the drug squad failed to properly register their sources. All three of the men deny any wrongdoing.
According to new figures, there were 194 cases of death due to drug overdose in 2016, an increase of 28 on the previous year. Men are overrepresented in the figures for drug deaths, which are one of the leading causes of death among men under the age of 40 in Finland.
We heard just now, Yle producers recently decided to remove clips by the children's music group Herra Heinämäki Shed Orchestra from its afternoon program, Pikku Kakkonen. The decision followed a social media controversy over the Native American costume worn by a band member. The removed clips have been transferred to ULA's archives.
And the Supreme Court rejected a prosecution request to appeal a three-year prison sentence handed down by a Pirkanmaa court for sex crimes committed against a 10-year-old girl in autumn 2016. Both courts threw out the charges brought against the man for aggravated rape. The courts ruled that there was no evidence to indicate that the sexual encounter involved violence or that the child was overcome by fear or incapacitated in any other way.
In health news, a major study has found that people who take a sauna every day have a 61% lower risk of stroke than those who go only once a week. The study followed 1,600 older people in Kuopio and divided them into those who visited the sauna 4 to 7 times per week, those who did so 2 to 3 times, and those who only went to the sweat box once a week. The study did not look at people who didn't take a sauna.
Christian pupils in northern Finland are choosing not to attend cultural performances that they find disturbing on religious grounds. The events are part of a national project launched in late 2017 that introduces pupils to different cultural offerings like art exhibitions, plays, concerts, and opera.
And teachers are cautious about a proposal to postpone the start of the school's summer vacation by 2 weeks. A ministerial report has suggested that the move could boost tourism industry revenues by about 200 million euros and increase employment in the sector.
Finland's air quality is better than that of any other country on Earth, according to statistics from the World Health Organization. Monitoring stations suggest there are some 6 micrograms of small particles per cubic meter of air in Finland, the lowest figure recorded worldwide.
Don't forget that you can stay up to date on all the news from Finland via our website at yle.fi/news.
Well, we've come to that point in the podcast where we have to take our leave. But before we do that, let's talk about the weekend. Personally, I'm going to be heading to Suomenlinna for the Voices from Death Row exhibition, a sound installation recalling the last hours of some 71 condemned prisoners captive on the island after the 1918 Civil War. What about you, Denise?
That sounds grim. I'll be going to Vantaa on Saturday, that's tomorrow, for the Extreme Run event. I'm told that I can look forward to tackling obstacles like Goliath's Gate, getting doused in water and foam, and climbing through tubes, and I can't wait. I think I need to point out here that there's also a kiddie version of the event on Sunday as well, so you might have to go to Vantaa this weekend as well, Egan.
That sounds very energetic, and I'm sure my kids would enjoy it. But how about you, Marianne?
Well, my weekend will sound boring compared to yours. I'm planning on eating well and reading, catching up on my reading. I have some work to do, so.
Are you going to be planning to write more books?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
What do you have in the pipeline?
I'm working now with photographer Uwe Iduose on a book that's about our parents' generation, so people who've migrated from mainly from different African countries in the last 50, 60 years to Finland. So we're kind of looking into their stories and what's happened in Finland at their time. And there's going to be also a lot of pictures of them to kind of like, the stories will be both in writing and in the photographs. So
we look forward to that.
Yes, and yes. You might have to come back and tell us more about that.
We do hope you do come back.
Gladly. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. But unfortunately, that's all from us this week. I'm Egan Richardson and my co-presenter was Denise Wall. Thanks to our special guest Marianne Abdul-Karim for stopping by. Our producer today was Mark Odom, reporter was Lydia Taylorson, and our sound engineer was Jarno Valkonen. Thanks for joining us and don't forget to subscribe, get in touch and even leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay up to date at yle.fi/news and listen to previous editions of this show at yle.fi/allpointsnorth.
You've been listening to All Points North, a podcast produced by Yle News, a unit of the Finnish Broadcasting Company. For daily news from Finland in English, head to yle.fi/news and follow us online at Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. You've been listening to Yle News.